Good morning, everyone. Well, we get a chance this morning to have a look back at some of the events in James that we did get a chance to look at in chapter 1 yesterday. Yesterday was just a beginning session, and hopefully today we can look at some things that maybe there wasn't time to look at yesterday and some of the background information in the book of James. I hope you can hear me in the back there. Back row, are you there? Just making sure. All right, this won't quite be like the class last night, guys, just so all you up front here know. But this one wasn't really for the kids, but it's okay. There's some pictures up there you can look at. Maybe you'll find some funny pictures as we go along. So get all that Sunday school work done, too, while you're at it. Now, James's letter. When you look at some of the things that are there, I showed you at that first night there. That was my family. For all of you that weren't here, at least, you can at least see that's my gang. The ones up at the top there, Steve and Fliss, they're the ones that are living over in Wollongong. And I just wanted to remind you, these two here, they're over in Australia right now. This fellow down here at the bottom, he was the one who created that the website that we have, the LavoniaTapes.com. So if you're not aware of that website, I'll probably throw it up there again in the second class. Tomorrow we'll have a look at it. Just to make sure you're aware that if you miss anything or you miss one of the classes or if we don't get to the last class on Friday, you can always download these things and have a look at them that way instead. Now, the story, when you look at the background, we're going to look at some of the background on the book of James this morning. If you just go back into the Acts of the Apostles, you can see a couple of the events that took place back there that formed some of the background as to what was happening when James wrote his letter. So, we know when you look at the concept that was happening in the first century, if you had been living back there, and you were living through the events back in Acts chapter 8, when Saul was consenting to Stephen's death, and you find out that, you know, if we had been alive at that time and Stephen was our friend and Stephen had been just stoned and you heard the news, we'd all be devastated by the fact that Stephen had been killed. And you can see that at that time there was a great persecution that arose against the church was at Jerusalem, and they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria except the apostles. So this would be one of the events back at that time that you can look at in somebody's life where when a trial came, like James was talking about in chapter 1, you had to ask wisdom of God to try to understand, why is this happening? Why did you just take away Stephen? He was one of our great speakers, one of the great defenders of the truth. Why would you do that at this time? And you find out, well, the reason is the angels had a bigger plan. It wasn't just about Stephen. It was that when the apostles were there in Jerusalem and when the first century ecclesia was forming, most of the believers wanted to stay together. They didn't want to separate. And it took the death of Stephen to scatter them. This was part of God's big plan. So as a result of Stephen's death, persecution arose and the believers were spread out. And they took the truth. They took the gospel out to the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles stayed there in Jerusalem. You find out that in Acts 11 at verse 19, the same kind of situation. Now those who were scattered after the persecution that arose over Stephen traveled as far as Phoenicia, Cyprus, Antioch, preaching the word to no one but the Jews only. So what had happened at this time is that because of Stephen's death, as bad as that was, and the people there immediately when it was happening didn't understand it, but if we trust God, he knows what he's doing. And his big plan was he wanted the gospel to go out to the Roman Empire. And this was the beginning of taking out the gospel to the Gentiles. So what they did is they left Jerusalem and some of them went north. They went up to Antioch up there in Syria. Some of them went over to Cyprus. And what they did at that time is they only spoke to Jews. They were still thinking this is Jewish only, Jewish only. And what God's trying to do is get them to expand the gospel to the Gentiles. And eventually that is what's going to happen. But what occurred at this time is that the original Jews that had left Jerusalem years ago, if you had been a Jew that had been around like before the days that when Jesus was crucified, if you had left Jerusalem and scattered out into the empire, you would have been looked down on by the Jewish community. You would be looked at as like one of the people that, what's the matter with you? You weren't, you know, didn't tough it out here in Jerusalem, or you didn't stay in the homeland, and you left and you went out to other areas of the empire. Those Jews that did that, that were looked down on, they had gone out into other areas and they had settled in and they had homes, they had jobs, they were well established. And now these Jews, right now, because of Stephen's death, they were being scattered out and now they were leaving home like you did, taking their caravans, taking whatever they could, they piled it on, they left their homes as a result of Stephen's persecution, and they come out with nothing. And they're going out into these areas now where these other Jews had been established that they used to look down on, and now those rich Jews were now looking down on the new Jews that were coming into their area. And so James writes his letter to try to bring some unity back to this diversity that had developed and the conflict that was there between the rich and the poor. You're going to see that in James's letter. That's why yesterday when we were looking at chapter 1, the very first example he picks about these issues he's trying to illustrate is we've got a lowly man and we've got a rich man. And you're all brought together in Jesus Christ. And he's trying to get unity in the Jewish community amongst the believers that have been scattered out at that time. So it helps to at least understand some of the background and the history of what was going on at that time. And you can see that, you know, from the Jewish perspective, a lot of those people would have not known at that time why this was happening when Stephen died. Why are we being forced out of the city of Jerusalem? Why are we having to leave the land right now? And they would have been questioning in their heads, is God in this? Is it all falling apart? Did we join the wrong community? You know, maybe we shouldn't be with these believers. Maybe we should have gone back to the synagogues. And all these kind of things would be going through their heads. And James is going to try to settle them down and say, look, you're on the right track. It's going to take endurance, and you've got to keep going. Don't go back. And he's going to warn them. You'll see the Apostle Paul deals with some of those same issues later on. So this is a typical thing, brethren and sisters. This is the challenge of our life. When events happen that are bad, it's usually the bad events. It's not the good ones. When the good events happen in our life, we joyfully say, wow, thank God for that. And we recognize God's involvement. But when tragedies hit, when trouble comes into our life, a lot of us tend to be double-minded. All of a sudden, we start to waver like the waves of the sea. And we get pushed by the events of the life one way and another way, and we lose that stability of the trust and the confidence that we have that God is involved. And this is really what James's letter was all about. So you can see in this little diagram right there, there's Jerusalem down in here. You can see that what ended up happening at that time, that this, the green lines right here, those are the Jews that had come in the day of Pentecost. And you can imagine that when they saw that was going on with the disciples and they understood, many of them were converted, thousands were being baptized, they went back to their homes. They went back to these areas right here, and these are the areas where the rich Jews were. They were well established because they had come into Pentecost from their homes, and then they went back to their homes when Pentecost was over. As a result of Stephen's death, now the gospel starts going up to Antioch, it goes over here to Cyprus. And then when the Apostle Paul was up in here working with the Jews at Antioch, he got sent from here on his first missionary journey, and he took the gospel up into Galatia up in there. And that's when Paul then wrote the letter to the Galatians as a result of that. So you're going to see that that actually comes into play with James's letter as well, that God really put both of those out at the same time. So when you look at the story of James, a lot of people wonder, well, which James was he? And I don't want to spend a lot of time on that, but we can at least acknowledge that those are some of the possibilities. There was James, the son of Zebedee, who's the brother of John. He's the one who's killed in Acts chapter 12. So that would have been James that was going around with Jesus as one of the 12 that were called. There's James, the son of Alphaeus, and possibly the brother of Matthew that we know very little about, really. There's also the son of Cleopas and Mary. He's called James the Less or James the Little. He's the brother of Joseph. And it's possible, nobody really knows for sure, but it could actually be connected. Some people think he might be the same as James the son of Alphaeus up in here as well. And then we have the half-brother of Jesus down here. And I would tend to think that that's probably the James who wrote this letter. In our community, if you look up in Christadelphian writings, you'll find that not everybody agrees on this, of course. That's typical amongst Christadelphia. We all have different views, and that's okay. But it isn't really critical for this letter. But some of the things that helped me understand this were that when you look at the respect that James had in Acts 15, when the Jerusalem Council was taking place, and James, the half-brother of Jesus, was there, and he lets Paul get up and give his speech, he lets Peter give his speech, James then gets up, pulls it all together, and you can see that he's definitely the leader in the first century ecclesia in Jerusalem. So he would have been the one brother that you would go to who must have had the respect of the Jews. They listened to him, and he tied it all together in Acts 15 and sent the letter out asking what they did in the four items in the Jerusalem conference. You also find that for folks that read Greek and know this better than I would, they said there's a lot of word parallels between the letter that James wrote and some of the wordage in Acts 15 in James's speech that's there. And also, there's a lot of connections to the words of Jesus, which many people think this would have been the result of James growing up with Christ, listening to his brother talk to him when they were younger, and listening to the stories that Jesus would tell. He probably formulated his parables and looked at the natural world and tried to develop issues for his family and lessons that they could learn from the natural world when they were young. And James would have heard all those things. And you'll see then that he relates those items in this story today. So yeah, this would have been the carpenter's son in Matthew 13 there. And when you look back at, you know, in terms of like James himself and growing up with Christ, he certainly would have known a lot of this, the stories Jesus told. He was well-versed in the law and the prophets. We know that. I mean, James, of all people, in Acts 15, when he actually quotes and talks about the tabernacle of David that was going to be raised up, and the argument that he uses when he quotes the Old Testament, he says, look, if in the kingdom the tabernacle of David is going to be raised up, remember that tent David set up that was out, it was away from the law? It was the tent that David set up, and it only had the ark. That was all when he brought back the ark to Jerusalem. And all that tabernacle stuff was still over there in Shiloh, and it was all set up back there. And David sets up a tabernacle, a tent, and it only has the ark. And that was when David had brought the ark into the city, and he had Jews and Gentiles in his community, and they were all worshiping together in this special tabernacle. Well, James says, look, if that's what's going to happen in the kingdom, why can't it happen now? It's good use of the Old Testament, and you could see that's the kind of fellow James was. You could imagine that Jesus would have challenged him growing up, because James, as a person growing up in his family, would have been a good Jew, and he would have been one of those good Jews who followed the law, you know, just as it was written, and they were doing the law thinking the law would save them. But Jesus would always be trying to get him to think a little bit outside the box about becoming a doer of the word and not just a hearer only. As Christ does when he gives the Beatitudes or when he gives any of his parables, he's always going outside the box. Don't get stuck in Judaism, but actually let this affect your life. This isn't just a law to be kept. This is a way of life to live, to be a member of God's family. He would have also experienced the firsthand prejudice against Jesus and the dependence that the Jews had on legalism. He saw that in his brother, watching that happen, and now he brings that into his letter and says, look, don't let this happen in our community. We don't want to do this. We don't want to have that kind of prejudice that leads to wars and fighting, as it did with the crucifixion of his own brother. And he certainly was called by Jesus after his own resurrection. You find out in 1 Corinthians 15 that Paul specifically says that he appeared unto James. He wanted to bring James into the fold, into the ecclesial family, because he knew, as he was working with James, he knew that James was going to be a very special person. Now, all that being said, when you look at how James introduces himself, he humbly comes in verse 1 of this book as James, the servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. And it's really a good spirit, brothers and sisters, for all of us to realize that no matter how close we were to Christ or what position we have in ecclesial life, this is James, he's like the leader of the Jerusalem ecclesia. When he writes the letter, he doesn't say all those things. He just says, I'm James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. And I think in our community today, all of us can learn some lessons from that, especially those of us that give classes in our ecclesias, speaking brethren that go around the world like me, and people in your ecclesia that are on arranging boards and all. When we get into positions in ecclesial life, we never want to forget we're no better than anybody else. All we are is a servant of the Lord Jesus Christ. We're here to help. We're all on the same level. God has given different gifts to different people. Some of the people at this camp right now have a really good gift for cooking food, and they do a wonderful job at that. Some of you are going to have the gift of doing Sunday school, and there's people over there that are going to be doing that in the classes to come. Some of you may be really good at singing classes, and you can teach singing in your ecclesia. So we can learn that hymn that I picked yesterday that didn't seem like anybody knew that tune of Father of Lights. I guess you don't sing that over here. Well, actually, that hymn we used to sing in the United States a lot when it had the old hymn book. It used to have a different tune. And then when they published the green book, they changed the tune on it. Nobody really likes that new tune anyway, so I'm not sure that gets used a whole lot in the U.S. anymore. I don't know, do we use that very much? A little bit, but not as much as we used to, maybe. The tune's just not as peppy. But we have different talents. And what we want to do in ecclesial life and family life is appreciate everybody's talents. And some people are good at one thing, some are good at another thing. and we'll look at that in the class later on this morning about God's use of ecclesias, is that God is the one, Jesus Christ himself, has given different talents to all of you that are here. Everybody has a talent for you to use in ecclesial life. And whatever that talent is, or those talents are, you use them, and we all learn to appreciate the fact that you can do things that I can't do. And I'm really glad you're here to do that, because there's no way I could do it all myself. And that's the way ecclesias run and work really well, when people appreciate each other. And you'll see that with James. So one of the reasons, at least, for writing this letter, when you try to look at the background as to why this letter is coming out, is that these Jews were going to be facing persecution right now and trouble from the rich Jews. From rich Jews. This is not persecution from Gentiles. This is persecution from their countrymen, from Jews. And this is what James is having to deal with. That's an important thing when you go to place the letter. This is not a Gentile-Jew problem. This is Jew-with-Jew problem that James is dealing with from the rich, established Jews. Too many of the Jewish believers had this belief system that really wasn't manifested in their way of life. They had a legal system, a law. They'd get up in the morning. They'd do things. They'd go through rituals. And they'd go through all these procedures thinking that, well, if I do all these things, I'm doing all the right stuff, and I'm going to earn my salvation. I'm going to go to God and say, look at all the things I did. And in the end, wow, I know I must be really good, and now you can save me because I kept all these legal rules. And they totally misunderstood the law. That isn't what the law was ever designed to do. The law was never designed to be an instrument you could check things off to think that we had somehow earned eternal life. That isn't what it was designed for. So it was a misuse of the law. And James is going to have to look at that like Paul does as well. Really what was supposed to happen is that you're looking at a faith, and James will do this. He says, look, if you really have the faith, then there'll be no way of turning off the works. Your works will show that you have the faith and will know, or as Paul would say, by their fruits we will know them. That you can actually see by somebody's way of life as to whether or not their belief system is really having an impact in their life. We've also got the problem of riches and covetousness were affecting some of them, and they were prejudiced against the poor. Prejudice was a problem in the Jewish community. And because of, I think, a bit of their system of thinking that if I'm rich and I have a lot of money and I'm healthy and things are going well for me, then God must like me. And if that's not happening for you, you must be doing something wrong. And that was a mentality that you see like back in Job's day. But it isn't just Job's day. This is a mentality that tends to just slowly infiltrate its way into our thinking. We like that because a lot of our days, things are going pretty good, and we think, well, if things are going well, and you know, I've got a job, and my family's there, and my kids are healthy, and things are going well, we want to believe that that's happening because I'm good. And that can really be a huge mistake, brothers and sisters. It may not be that at all. It may be God's kindness and his blessings that he's giving you an opportunity to develop. And it's not about us being good, because when what we do is we look at somebody else who isn't having that, and things aren't going so well for you, and you're not having those kind of situations, and we look at them and we think, well, they must be really doing something wrong, and you know, the angels are doing something in your life to try to fix you. And that's the way we look at other people. And that is not a good spirit to have in family life and ecclesial life. That's not good at all. And so James is going to try to correct some of that prejudice that came into the ecclesia at that time. And it got so bad when they started getting together between the Jews. These are Jews and Jews. You know, some of you have probably seen, you know, pictures or movies or something how Jews are a pretty emotional group of people. And when they get together, you know, sometimes we think our arranging meetings are good, and maybe you have some good ones over here where people get a little excited, or ecclesial business meetings. Do you ever have exciting ecclesial business meetings over here? You know, in America, sometimes brethren get a little bit charged up, or sisters in ecclesial business meetings. Well, Jews, when they start talking with each other, they can really go at it. And when you get to chapter 4, you're going to see that Paul would talk about, you know, what are these wars and fightings amongst you? What is this? James would, he would say, what's going on? And it could be they were just verbal wars, but the actual word in the Greek actually seems to indicate it's possible that some of them even came to like physical abuse, that they were actually going after each other in terms of their arguments that they were having. So James tries to correct all those things. I don't think there's really one specific reason. He's really attempting to look at all those different issues. If you're trying to nail down about when the letter was written, my conclusions were, and many others have thought the same thing, but not everybody, that it was probably an early letter. I'd say it's probably before Paul's first missionary journey. I think there's good reason for that. You're going to have to date it before the missionary journey. The persecution was by rich Jews, not Gentiles. This is not a Jew-Gentile problem, which is probably why this was before Paul's missionary journey. As soon as Paul took the gospel out to the Gentiles, immediately he had the problem of Jew and Gentile, and he couldn't ever get rid of that. Everywhere he went, this became a huge problem in ecclesial life. So the fact that this is not a problem is probably an indication that this was before the gospel was going out to the Gentiles. There's no mention really of any Gentile problems in James's letter at all. It's always Jews versus Jews. It was late enough, though, for James' authority to be established. In order for him to write this letter and send it out to the strangers that were scattered abroad, he must have had the respect of these people to write to them. So it was probably somewhere around Acts 12 or so when that was established, and by Acts 15 we know he was the leader at the Jerusalem conference. And it was early enough that the inclusion of the Gentiles was really not a major issue. So because of all those reasons, when you start to look at where do you want to put it, most people would put the letter in terms of this period right in here, somewhere between 45, 46 A.D. And basically what you're looking at is it's after James, the brother of John, was killed in Acts 12, and before Paul went on his first missionary journey. That happens to be, that's a blow-up of that CSSS chart or whatever. You guys have that over here, right? We get ours from you guys, so somebody over here must have that. That's Australian. Everybody have those? No? That's an Australian Bible insert. We get all our good stuff from Australia. We use it. Hope you guys do too. Anyway, that's a big long chart that they have available, so that's where that came from. But probably that would end up in this period right in here as to when James wrote that letter. And that's just a probably. We don't know that for sure. Now, one of the other things that this letter fits in really well with is Paul's letter to the Galatians. And I didn't realize this until I was doing a study for James and also something for Galatians one year and started reading books on both and finally realized that many in our community had caught on to this. Maybe you have already. I hadn't. But here's the way this works. James is really going to balance out Galatians because really what happens in the community is that the pendulum can shift one way or the other. It can shift towards the fact that, well, you know, since the gospel of grace is going out, when Paul preaches the gospel of grace, and because we're saved by grace, do you really have to do anything? No, we're just saved by the grace of God. And so we can just sort of sit back, take our little couch chairs right there, enjoy, watch everybody else work, because we're saved by grace. And so, you know, you might as well even continue sinning. Like, why bother fighting sin? Let's think, if you sin some more today, then God will give you even more grace. What a great idea. And so some of the believers were actually thinking along those lines, that since we're saved by grace, why not just sit back and enjoy the ride? Why not have a life, but you don't have to fight sin? Because what will end up happening is that God's grace will cover you. And so that's one end of the pendulum. The pendulum can swing the other way, though, and instead of that, we had the Judaizer mind that was in the first century ecclesia, because a lot of these people had been previous Jews growing up under Judaism. And the Judaism people were thinking, I've got to do all this stuff. I've got to do this. I've got to do this because I'm trying to be good enough so that God wants to save me. And they're looking at it from me up kind of thing, that I'm going to earn my way up to where I'm so good that God will want to save me. And that was their mentality. And so what you see then is that James and Paul, and the letters to the Galatians and the letter to James, they look at both of those extremes. And they try to bring those people back into the center. And you'll see that the Apostle Paul does that when he writes this letter to the Galatians. When he gets to chapter 5 after his expositional part, in chapters 5 and 6 he gets into the fruit of the Spirit and he gets into all these issues about what this should mean. And he talks about what matters is faith working through love. This is what it's about. It's a faith that works, like James is going to say, through love. Love is the motivating power of this. It isn't a faith that's just keeping a list of ritualistic laws. Oh, no. This is a faith that's motivated by love so that when you see a need in the community, like an ant, you jump in and you fill the need. Not because there was some law that said this is what you're supposed to do, but because you love the people. That's a powerful faith. And so Paul comes at it from that perspective when he writes to the Galatians, and James is going to do the same thing when he writes his letter to these Jews. So Galatians is correcting this side of it. He goes after the Judaizers, and James is going to correct the problem of the hearers only, the people that would just say, oh yeah, more grace, that's okay. Might as well sin that grace may abound, or I really don't need to do much in life. And it's a tough pendulum, because what ends up happening for all of us, brothers and sisters and young people, is that if you analyze your life right now, you will find that as a person, you are either over on the right, you're over here thinking you're earning your way to salvation, or you're one of these people over here that tends to be the hearers only. All of us are out of balance. And that's why we're here. That's why we come to ecclesias. That's why God's given us families. That's why we interact with each other. We're all helping each other find the balance that's there, that is perfectly manifested in the Lord Jesus Christ, this issue of faith working through love. And that's the balance that we want to come to. So as we go through James's letter, I hope you can see that some of the people that analyze the Bible, and they analyze it critically, and they like to pick at pieces of the Bible, they like to look at James's letter right here, and they like to think that what James is doing is he's against Paul. They think he's got a different kind of gospel, that Paul has the gospel of grace and James has the gospel of works. And they look at James and say that he's not really in agreement with Paul at all. I remember we used to go see some folks at, we used to go meet with these people that we were trying to help them understand the truth. It was a group of people that got together, and they were followers of Paul only. They would only use Paul's writings in the New Testament because he taught the gospel of grace. They wouldn't even read James's stuff because they thought James was off the wall, because his ideas were all about works and doers of the word, and that can't possibly fit into Paul's gospel of grace. And that's a mistake. Both Paul and James are aiming at the same thing, but they're coming at it from different sides. One of them's dealing with the problem of earning salvation, and the other one's coming at it from the perspective of those people who thought, I don't have to do anything. I've been saved. I guess it would be very similar to our once saved, always saved philosophy that you have in Christianity today. And James goes after that and says, oh no, if you really are saved, if you really have the faith, you won't be able to stop the works. They will flow from your faith. And that's what James is going to try to show. And those of you that are having trouble in ecclesial life and family life, and you can't control your tongue, and you can't overcome prejudice, the reason you can't is because you don't have a faith that's active. You don't have that. You just have a system of beliefs, and you think you're saved. So this is what James does. He goes after that and tries to show that period. Let's try to bring us back to that central point. This really was a transition period for the Jews at this time. If you had been living back in the first century ecclesia, it would be tough, because you would be amongst Jews, mainly Jews at this period, and these Jews would have understood the gospel of grace, some would have understood what God was doing, but many of the Jews had a cultural background where they had come up under the law, they had gone to synagogue school all their life, and some of them were still in the synagogues. Because when the gospel went out, they didn't say you can't go to the synagogues. They said, if you go, that's fine, but don't think that's going to save you. And this is what Paul would try to correct the Jews on. But that would be tough to have believing Jews in your community that were still going to the synagogues, still visiting the temple, and still going through some of the sacrifices. They had believers that were still doing this. And so Paul would have to say, and James would have to allow for the fact, well, if you want to do that, like if you want to go to the temple and offer sacrifices, if that's what you want to do, that's okay. But don't tell everybody else in the group that they all have to do that. And this is the kind of stuff that goes on in ecclesial life. Some people, once in a while, they get into a little area and they think, I want to do this, I'm going to do this, and they do it for a while. And then they come back and say, well, everybody else should be doing this too. And so they have to very carefully handle that issue, and Paul would say, well, that's okay. If you want to do that, go ahead. But don't tell everybody else they have to do that. And while you're doing that, you better make sure you realize that's not going to save you. You can do that if you think it helps you develop faith, but don't think that's going to save you. So that's the kind of very careful way that Paul and James would tread on these issues. And the Jewish community still had a big impact on the believers. In fact, actually, in James chapter 2, that word that's there in the Greek for the assembly or whatever you have in your version, that's actually the same word that's used for synagogues. That's what they were looking at as their community coming together, that they were like a little synagogue. And many of these Jewish believers still kept the law. They were still going through these rituals. The problem with the Jewish background, when you look at James's letter and trying to understand what he's going after, is that a lot of this stuff, a lot of these people he's writing to, they still depended on their Jewish heritage. They thought they were the chosen people. We are the ones. And this was typical of the Jewish thinking of that time. We are the special people. This is why when Paul wrote Romans, when he writes to Rome, and he's writing to Gentiles who are now thinking they are the people, we are the Romans, and he's got Jews in the community who think they are the people. That's why when he goes after the Romans in chapters 1 and 2, he first of all knocks down the Gentiles in chapter 1, and then he knocks down the Jews in chapter 2, and by chapter 3 he says, don't you get it? None of us are any good in the eyes of God. That nobody is ever going to make their way and earn the way up to this, neither Jews nor Greeks. And so he ends up introducing the idea that God did what the law could not do, and he sent his son who would declare the righteousness of God. So this was a common problem in the first century ecclesia of dealing with Jews who thought they were special. They were better than the other people. And so what they thought then when the gospel of grace went out, they started thinking eventually that they were better than others. They figured that they were better even than the other Jews, because not only we Jews, we're Jews that understand the gospel of grace. We've got the grace of God. And all those other Jews, they don't have that. So that puts us even a notch up above them. And again, this was because of Jewish mentality and the kind of thinking that they would have had, the culture that they grew up with. And because they were thinking that God would save them because they're Jews in the end, and not so much because of the impact of their behavior. So what James has to do then is go after this group of people and say, look it, you can't rest on your laurels of being Jewish. You can't rest on the fact that you grew up in a Jewish community, you have Jewish culture, you have all this stuff or whatever. Don't trust in your riches. Don't trust in any of this stuff. You've got to become a doer of the word. You've got to be somebody who lets the word impact your life so that you're not doing works of law, but you're doing works of faith. You're doing the kind of things that faith generates in people who see a need in the ecclesia, and you help somebody because they're in need, not because there's some rule written down that says, I've got to do this. See, that's what really this is all about. So that if one of us at the camp right here became really sick and they ended up going to hospital and they're in the hospital and now they're sitting in the hospital instead of being here at the camp, some of us would be thinking it would be really nice to go visit them in the hospital. Now, some of you would be thinking, well, I better go visit them in the hospital because the Bible says I'm supposed to go visit them in the hospital. And we go at it from the perspective of like Matthew 25, unless you do it under the least of these, my brothers, you do it under me. So we're going at it from a rule. And so this is the mind, the thinking of the Jew. We do it because we have to. Others of you would be thinking, oh, that poor person, they're missing the Bible school. And you care about them, and you want them to feel a part of it. And you go over there to see them, to help them, to try to make them feel better about their situation, and to comfort them in their affliction. That's a whole different spirit than the brethren and sisters or the young people who go over there because I have to go over there because it's the right thing to do. And what we want to get to, brethren and sisters, what James aims at, is don't live because you have to. Do it because you love them. It's a faith that's generated by love, to where you by your works, you show the faith that you really have. Not because you're going at it through a system of legal law, but because you really love the people. That's tough to get to in life. And I think what happens for most of us is we start out with the legal. We start out, the Bible says I've got to do this, and this, and this, and this. But what we want to get to eventually is to where we live as real people who are motivated by love. And that's the goal. And God's given us our families to try to teach us about that. So that when you have your children, you have a spouse, and you have people you love, you find out how it works. And the goal then is to expand that out to beyond your own family, to expand that all out to God's family. That's what we're really after in ecclesial life. So this is what James goes after. That's at least one of the areas that he's trying to tackle. If you look in James's letter, you'll see in chapter 1, when we read through that yesterday, look at all the allusions that were there to nature in James's letter. This was just chapter 1. You'll see even more in 2, 3, 4, and 5. But it helps us realize that James was the kind of person, it was like a down-to-earth guy. He would have been out in the fields, out in the boats. This would be his life. And so when he wants to give you an analogy, what he does is he goes to some of the things you know from nature, things that you experience in your life, the waves of the sea, the flower of the field, the human life cycle in chapter 1 about conceiving and having a child, the shadow of turning, the idea they would have seen with the sundials, and the idea that everything is moving in relation to the sun and the sun casts shadows. There's a lot of these natural things like this that James would look at in this letter. You'll see more as we go along. Now, we looked yesterday at verses 2 to 11 in the exhortation at this idea that James starts out with his crux issue is that when troubles come, we've got to have this confidence, this inner confidence that we really believe God is in the trouble. If we're not like that, we're double-minded. That's what he calls this. We've got a mind that says, yeah, God's involved in my life sometimes, other times he's not, and there's just some random events, random chance, and so God's not in this part of my life over here. James says that won't work because you're going to respond the wrong way to those problems if you really don't trust that God's in them. So that's really what he tackles right up front. And I know in our community, we don't always have agreement on this. This is something we talk about back home a lot, this idea that is God really in all the events of our life? But this is where James starts, and I really believe he knows this is the crux of the issue. If we're single-minded and we really believe the good and the bad, that God is in it all, then we will respond the way God wants us to and we'll grow spiritually instead of letting this life lesson get totally missed because we just couldn't face it as something God was involved in. I thought that yesterday, if there had been more time in the exhortation, it might have been worth looking at. You know, one of the passages people go to that don't really follow this view of God is involved in everything. It's interesting that a lot of times you'll see folks go back to Ecclesiastes 9 and 11, but time and chance happen to them all. I just thought it might be worth looking at the passage just so that you can see. In Ecclesiastes 9, it's interesting to me that when I talk to folks who don't believe God's involved in every aspect of their life, this is the verse they go to, Ecclesiastes 9 and 11. It's like there's one verse in the Bible that doesn't support this, and that's it, one verse, and we're going to build a case on one verse. But I really don't think the passage itself even supports that concept if you just look at it within its context. Because what people generally do is they read the verse, but they don't really read the context. So if you look in Ecclesiastes 9 just for a second and actually look at what's there, look at the context of chapters 8 and 9. At the end of chapter 8, when he was looking at the enjoyment of man, at verse 15, I commended the enjoyment because a man has nothing better under the sun than to eat and drink and be merry, for this will remain with him in his labor for the days of his life which God gives him under the sun. Now, this is how he saw it, really. These were the days of your life which God gives you. This is not just random events. These are the days that God has given you. You see, in chapter 9, when he starts out at verse 1, for I commanded all this in my, I considered all this in my heart, so I could declare it all, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. It's all in the hand of God. This is his perspective at this point. This isn't like some of it's in God's hand and some of it isn't. It's all in the hand of God. You see in verse 9 of chapter 9 again, to live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life which he has given you under the sun, which he has given you. It's all in God's control. So when he gets down to verse 11, then you start to realize, well, what is this about? And look at what he says. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift. In other words, if you're a fast runner, we got Ironman here. Go, yeah, same for the Ironman race, right? And you're a fast runner, and you think, I'm going to train, and I'm going to run, and I'm so fast, I'm going to be able to win. And he realizes that, wait a minute, that isn't really what happens here. It's not about how well I train and whether or not I can make it. See, and the race isn't to the strong either, see? Sometimes it's good to have all that help. You all right? You literally almost fell into trials, right? It's always good to have a practical example. But Solomon's point is, the race isn't to the swift. You might be the fastest runner, but you may not win the race. And the battle isn't to the strong. You might have the best army, and you go out to fight, and you lose the war. And you might have nor bread to the wise. You might be the wisest person, but in the end, you have trouble getting a job, and you don't have economic support. And you see, he's doing all this, and he says, nor favor to the men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. Because from our perspective, even though we're good at this, and we think we are the best, we go out there and we do it, and we find out it doesn't always work. And so from our perspective, it's actually the word that's used there for chance is like an occurrence. But time and occurrence happen to them all. It doesn't always work out that way. Why not? Why doesn't it always work out that way? That's because God's in control. And he changes what we would have liked to do. We think we're going to be okay because I'm really smart and I got a good job and economically I'm going to be all set. And God gets involved and all of a sudden we lose our job. Or we think we have good health. We go out and we work out. We're really strong. We're physically fit. And all of a sudden we get hit with cancer. Or we get hit with some illness. Because God is involved in your life. It's not time and chance of just chance events. It's the fact that things happen that were out of our control, and even though we were really good at something, it doesn't really happen in the end. You see in verse 12 there, for a man does not know his time. Doesn't know his time. This is the time he's been talking about in chapters 8 and 9 that are under the control of God. God's got it all under control, but we don't. And that's actually, I really think what's happening in Ecclesiastes 9, it's not really chance or random events. If you're wondering, just in terms of like the Hebrew word usage, it's sort of fun if you get a computer Bible, you grab your Strong's Concordance. If you go back to 1 Kings 5, and verse 4, the only other place that word, that's the Hebrew word is translated in our Bible is the word chance. The only other time it's used is in 1 Kings 5 and 4. This is a good example of how just a little bit of Bible study goes a long way. If you really thought this was just chance events that happen in our life that are like outside of God's control and these things just happen to you and God really isn't involved in those things, look at this, 1 Kings 5. Who is this about? It's about Solomon, the same man who wrote Ecclesiastes 9. And he's talking to Hiram, the king of Tyre, in Ecclesiastes 5 at verse 1. And he sends to the servants of Solomon because he'd heard about what Solomon was doing. And Solomon sent to Hiram. He sends him a letter. And look at what he says. You know how my father David could not build a house for the name of the Lord his God, in verse 3, because of the wars which fought against him on every side, until the Lord put his foes under the soles of his feet. God put it all under control. But now, the Lord my God has given me rest. Who's in control? God's in control. The Lord my God has given me rest on every side so that there is neither adversary nor evil occurrence. Well, that's that word. That's that same word that was used in Ecclesiastes 9. These are not random events that are outside of God's control. These are things that God is in control of. There are no random events out of his control. He can't afford that. I mean, you look at it, brothers and sisters, from the perspective of parents. If you were doing the best parenting you possibly could, you know you would be with your child all the time. They'd never wander out the door and be out of your sight. You would be watching them, and you'd be in control, and you'd want to do that to help them and to guide them. Well, look, God sends his angels out, those ministering spirits for us, and they're working in our lives. They're with us every moment. There's no events that they're not involved in. They're there all the time, and they see it all. And yes, there may be some times where things happen to us, but they have control over it as to whether they want to let it happen or they don't. They have the control. So that if something does develop in us, and we happen to have cells that go cancerous, they can control that. They can decide whether or not they want to let that happen. When you're driving down the road and a car pulls out in front, they can control whether they want to let you have an accident or they don't. This is all under their control because they're raising you for God's family. And they're the best parents you could ever have because they're not limited by the limits that we all have in our human life. And they're not doing it for their good. They're doing it for your good so that you can join the family and share God's holiness. That's what the angels are really all about. If you want to throw another one in there, I was just looking at that story in 1 Kings 22. You remember the case where Ahab wanted to have the war against Syria? So he invites Jehoshaphat up to the north. Remember 1 Kings 22? And Micaiah is in prison. They bring out Micaiah because he was the only prophet of Yahweh. And they bring out Micaiah and they ask Micaiah in the end, all right, tell us what's really going to happen. Remember when he finally says, after his sarcastic thing, that I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains like sheep without a shepherd? And you remember how Ahab, he sort of believed that and realized, whoa, maybe he's right. You remember what Ahab did? What did he do when he went out to battle? You remember what he did? He sort of believed Micaiah. So when he went out to battle, did he put on all his king's robes and go out to fight like the king of Israel? Did he? No. Who did he give the king's robes to? Hey, Jehoshaphat, why don't you put them on today? You get all the glory. And he dumps them off on Jehoshaphat. And Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah in the south, he's got this stuff on. So they go out to fight, remember? And they're going out to have the war. And all of a sudden, the Assyrians, they find out, where's Jehoshaphat? There he is. And they go after the guy in the king's robe. And they're going to kill him. And then they realize, you're not Ahab. And so they let him go. And Jehoshaphat doesn't get killed. And you remember the story? It says that somebody at random just drew a bow and shot and killed Ahab. They nailed him. And that's the way it's presented, that it was just at random they shot. Now, was that really at random? God had said ahead of time. He said to his angels, who's got a plan so Ahab will fall at Ramoth-Gilead? The plan all along was that God was going to make sure Ahab died in that battle. So although it may look from our perspective like it's random, oh no, it's all under control of the angels. They've got it all figured out. So I really think that's what's happening here in James chapter 1. He's trying to give us that assurance that none of this is outside of God's control. He's in control of it all. Now, verses 12 to 18 that we sort of looked at yesterday in James 1, when we were looking at the exhortation, that section looks at this idea of how God can use these trials then to turn us into children of God. So that he dealt with the fact that when trouble comes upon you, well, what's God really trying to do? If something happens to you in your life and you lose your job or something goes on where you and your spouse are having trouble and you're not getting along real well, did God do that to you because he wants you to fail? No. He puts us in those circumstances so that we will learn to trust him and so that we will spiritually grow. That's what James says. He doesn't do it so that you'll sin. That's not what God's after. He's not one of those people who tempts you so that you'll fail. Now, people that go to public school, they see that amongst some of the teachers. Teachers will do that once in a while. They'll present situations to children, knowing that the kids can't do it, and they lead them into a situation where they know they're going to fail. And I guess that somehow makes the teacher feel better. I'm not really sure what that's for. Or sometimes children do that to each other, where kids will pick on each other. You'll see that sometimes in your neighborhoods, in your school, where people will do things to you, and they're hoping that you'll lose it. I used to have kids come into school where some of our low-end kids, and their goal at the beginning of the day when I would talk to them, they would say, well, their goal was to get a teacher so mad that they lose their cool that day and just blow up and explode in front of a class. That was their goal for the day. That was fun for them. But see, God's not like that. He's not trying to do things to us so that we fail. He puts us in these circumstances so that he can help us develop into his children. And that's the warning that James gave us in verse 16. But don't be deceived when these kind of things happen, my brethren. Don't be fooled. God's not out to destroy you. He's out to save you. And it takes tough medicine to save us. I really think that, when you look back in our human history, and you look at us as people, most of us, when we come in the truth and we're baptized, although we answer the questions and we go through all the stuff and we're baptized, I'm not sure we really believe we're as bad as we say. And as time goes on and you start to realize how our brain really thinks and how against God our brain really is, then you start to see that in circumstances of life when we get challenged. And our brain wants to react one way, and our spiritual mind says, wait a minute, I can't do that. And you see this happen so many times, you start realizing that, wow, this is really tough for God to change this brain. By nature, I just want to go down this pathway. And he's got to work in my life day after day, patiently, just gently trying to redirect me through the influence of his implanted word so that I'll learn to think like him. That's really tough for God to do. And he sends out his angels. And Jesus Christ is involved in your life. He's doing these things in order to help us learn so that we can end up being a part of his family forever. So that was really the intent of those verses. In verse 18, you could see of chapter 1, of his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth that we might be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. So this wasn't some random event that you just happened to be brought into the Christadelphian community because mom and dad were Christadelphians and then you got introduced. It's God's election. It's of His own will. He picked every one of us. His election. Paul deals with that in Romans 9. He just says, look, this is God's choice. He didn't pick Esau, he picked Jacob. He didn't pick Ishmael, he picked Isaac. This is God's election. It's His choice. Of His own will, He's reborning you. You're like being born again. He calls it our rebirth. And He's bringing us forth according to be like first fruits of His creature. And the way He does that is by implanting His word into our brain. And then it starts to grow like a seed so that we'll develop spiritually instead of have the mentality that we do so often where we react according to the flesh. Now, in verses 19 to 27, just to finish up this section here, in fact, I should have asked you, are we done at 10? Are we done at, it's 10 o'clock, so we're pretty much done at 10. So then you get like an hour break, is that right? Hour break, okay, I wasn't sure. All right, we'll look at that section there at the end there in verses 19 on when he starts looking at the godly characteristics we need to endure trial. And we'll move on to that and have a look at chapter 2 then in the next class tomorrow. And then in our next class today, what we're going to do is look at God's choice of ecclesias to try to figure out, like, why does he use ecclesias? And why are ecclesias good? And why should we stick it out in ecclesias even though there's some bad times? God's had good use for the ecclesias, and this is his developing ground. This is the arena where he develops his children in ecclesial life. So, leave it there for today. Thank you.